Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the website that brings readers and writers together to make great books, and the sponsor of Backlisted. Today, we're coming to you from the Durham Book Festival, an annual event that first started in 1990, which means it's one of the oldest of the UK's book festivals. Yes. The events this year, there are many authors performing: David Baddiel, Michael Mulpurgo, Pat Barker, Catherine Williams, and it was also, last night, was the Durham Book Festival is now the place where the Gordon Byrne Prize, I think one of the most interesting of the UK's literary prizes, was launched, and last night it was the winner was announced. Andy.
I'm Andy Miller, I'm the author of The Year of Reading Dangerously, and I am the reader in residence at the Durham Book Festival this year. The best thing about reader in residence is people keep saying to me, what is that? we're making it up as we go along, but basically I'm an ambassador for all the authors who either couldn't be here because they're dead or they weren't free this weekend. One of those.
That's quite a weight to have on your shoulders.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I'm bound a publisher in residence as well, which is really nice.
They've also got a vlogger in residence here.
Have they?
It's hard to know what they don't have in residence at the Durham Book Festival, to be honest with you. And anyway, we are ensconced today, it says in my script. We are ensconced today with a very knowledgeable and good-looking audience.
Well
again,
done,
a polite ripple of laughter there. In the bijou surroundings of Durham's Gala Theatre Studio, and we are delighted to welcome as our guest, little round of applause, please, Sally Bailey.
Thank you.
Dr. Bailey is a teaching and research fellow at the Rothermere American Institute, University of Oxford, and a lecturer in English at Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford. She's also a filmmaker and the author of a number of books, including most recently The Private Life of the Diary, A History of the Diary as Art Form. And in fact, you were just doing an event, Sally, weren't you,
about this
with John?
We were talking about diary and the importance of a diary for the development of a sense of self, a place where particularly younger people can try out different selves, and how to some degree that's under threat from the instant shareability of photographs and tweets. And although the book is as much a history of brilliant diarists, Virginia Woolf, Samuel Pepys, even Alan Clark, we talked about this morning.
Even Alan.
And Alan Clark was a brilliant diarist, if perhaps not a
man of
delightful
diary
man.
Style. No, absolutely. We also spoke about the diary as a place where you store away your reading life as well. So Virginia Woolf was one of the heroes of my book, and in a sense a role model for anyone who wants to be a diarist. She used her diary as a storehouse for her reading. So in a sense, it's also her library.
Now, normally what we do on Backlisted is that John and I ask one another what we've been reading. Also, I have to add today, we'd normally be joined by the author and somnambulist, Matthew Clayton. But the last time we did one of these in front of an audience, Matthew lost his mind and stripped to the waist and dove into the audience at the end. So he wasn't allowed to come to this one.
He's been banned.
So there won't be any tenuous links other than any we provide ourselves or we ask you for. So again, be ready. But normally, John and I would ask one another about what we've been reading. We're not going to do that today, are we, John?
No, we're going to ask you what you've been reading. To what end, I'm not sure, but we will. It'd be fascinating to know what people coming to the Durham Book Festival have been reading, and whether that chimes with any of the stuff that we've been looking at, which is in Andy's case more than is almost humanly possible, and in my case, much more humanly possible.
So we've got a mic.
A roving mic.
Roving mic. If you've been reading something that you feel you want to tell us about, please just put your hand up.
I've been reading, I mention it because you mentioned the Gordon Byrne Prize last night, and I was reading the winning book, David Solé's All That Man Is, and it's also on the Booker list, shortlist, and I would thoroughly recommend it to anyone here. It's made up of nine connected stories in some ways, connected in theme, about different men at different ages and the frailty and issues that we all have And I think it was said best by one of the judges that he recognised himself horribly in most of them, even one when a guy was 72, which was 20 years' time for the judge until he reached that age. But I thoroughly recommend it.
Yes, it was. It stood out, actually, that the themes that he was saying had kind of history had overtaken Brexit and a migration crisis were not things that were perhaps current when he'd started writing the book, but it's become more relevant and poignant as time has gone on, which is fascinating. It's impossibly just on the Gordon Byrne Prize. It seems to me of all the prize shortlists I can think of, it's the one that is. It's almost impossible to imagine how you can come up with a winner because the range of experience that's encompassed by it just seems so remarkable.
The thing that Anthony of Anthony and the Johnsons said when he won the Mercury, he said, "How this is like choosing a prize between a peach and a table, and a car and an apple."
Yeah,
you know, or something like that. I did think while we were sitting there listening to some amazing readings last night.
Incredible, yeah.
It's very difficult. I tell you what, with the David, is it Sazley?
Shalloy, I think.
Do you ever have that thing of that when the Booker Long List came out a few months ago? Several people recommended that one to me, and I didn't read it quickly. And now it's on the short list, and it's won this prize. I'm already thinking, I can't. Yeah. Which is unfair. I don't say that proudly, but I know how wanting to read something works. And sometimes you miss a moment. Like if you get it. Like I read we were talking about The Sellout by Paul Beattie.
Yeah.
Which is also on the Booker shortlist.
Yeah,
I read that a couple of months ago, almost as an unknown quantity. And the fact that it was an unknown quantity.
You talked about it on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
It was interesting because I had a bit of one of those, should I or shouldn't I? And then I thought you'd used two words, which was that you'd said it was quite hard going. And you said it was great, but I took an easier option. Which I'm not going to talk about because I want to talk about is a book which I guarantee will become a prize winner and a classic, which is The Underground Railway by Colson Whitehead.
Underground Railroad.
Road, sorry, Underground Railroad, yeah.
We're going to talk about it on the next podcast, aren't we? Because we both read that. Yeah. So. Yeah, has anybody else been reading anything? Yes!
Yes.
Do say your name. That was David Roach, the last question. I can
Thank you, David.
Hello, I'm Ben Myers. Yeah, I'd like to recommend a book called The Glue Ponies by a writer called Chris Wilson. I've just read it. It's come out on Tangerine Press, who are a small publisher based in Tooting, South London, run by a chap called Michael Curran, who's actually a carpenter, and he's become a bookmaker, like literally makes the books as a craft. He's published James Kelman recently, Billy Childish. He makes beautiful books, which sell out straight away, sometimes £50, £75, £100 an edition. But yeah, The Glue Ponies is a collection of stories by a guy from Newcastle, Chris Wilson, who moved to America when he was young and got a terrible heroin habit and went into a life of petty crime and ended up in San Quentin prison for years.
Yeah,
just looking at me like, real uplifting read. But no, there's a lot of it's short stories. Yeah. Basically, he came out of San Quentin prison, moved back to England, went to Chelsea Art School, got a first in art, and is now a painter. But he's also a brilliant writer. And they're really dark, hard-hitting short stories.
Great title.
I've written it on the back of my hand.
Well, it's actually, I can't see what's on your hand from here, but it's ponies, P-O-N-Y-S, instead of I-E-S. Just
that's
pedantic.
Wrong, I've got that wrong now. I've written something wrong on the back of my hand.
But yeah, it's a very short story, it's very hard-hitting, very bleak. The standout story, and I won't get into it, but it involves a sort of very large black transsexual and a white Aryan Nazi and an encounter in a hotel room with a lot of methamphetamine.
I am crazy for that genre. Well, I love that genre.
I know. Well, we had a drink last night in Durham, didn't we? So I saw how it went. So I know that's your thing. So yeah, The Glue Ponies by Chris Wilson.
Do you think Tangerine Press have got any copies left?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and Chris Wilson's doing readings and events at the moment.
Fabulous.
He's a really interesting, engaging guy with a hybrid accent that's part Geordie, part San Quentin prison,
I'm
patois.
I'm so there for the...
He lives in South London.
Glue
So, Ben, you've passed the audition. Congratulations.
Thank you,
thank you very much. Has anybody else been reading anything they'd like to tell us about?
Yep.
Yes.
Ah, go on.
Hello, I'm one of your listeners.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for coming.
And a book that I've been reading was inspired by the tweets coming from you and Andrew Mayle about Virago Press and early 1980s editions. And I went into a bookshop in Pickering and they had hundreds of them on a shelf, and I didn't know which one to pick, so I just randomly picked one out by Gisela Elsner, and it's called Offside, and it's set in Munich, and it's about suburbia, and she's a kind of stifled character taking tranquilizers all day, and she ends up having risky sex, and it's a carry-on. A wonderful book in many ways. It's very German in the style, so there are virtually no paragraph breaks.
Is it translated from the German?
Yes. Yeah.
And when does it date from?
I think it's 1982.
Okay.
Have either of you heard of it?
No.
I haven't heard of it. At my event that I just did here at Durham, I was talking a bit about Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner, and I was saying that Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner beat J.G. Ballard's The Empire of the Sun to the Booker Prize. And last week I read The Empire of the Sun for the first time. It was all right. But Hotel du Lac was much better. And a man in the audience jeered and disagreed. And I said to him, should we take this outside UKIP style so we can brawl over who was better, Anita Bruckner or J.G. Ballard? I can understand that. I believe that when Anita Bruckner won for Hotel du Lac, that there was a lot of ill feeling because people felt Ballard had written his most important book and should be acknowledged for it.
If I'm not mistaken, it was 87, wasn't it?
84.
It's 84, right.
It's the time of the miners' strike, isn't it, in England?
Yes, that's right.
It's a very quiet book, though. I mean, it's so quiet, and I think people sometimes have a problem with quiet books, and it's a book about a writer having a crisis and going to Europe in order to sort it out.
As listeners to this podcast will know, basically, we're changing the name of this podcast to Bruckner Listed. And it will be a non-stopping going into Anita Bruckner.
The perfection of, somebody was saying when she writes the same book every time, and I say, well, surely that's kind of like Bark variations. I mean, they may be similar, but they're so exquisite and perfect.
Yeah.
It's like a tiny, tiny drop of Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, which is also about going to the mountains recomposing yourself. And it's a modest touch at that. And I think she pulls it off.
The book chat will continue on the other side of this message. We're here to talk about Stevie Smith and her third and final novel, The Holiday. Before we talk about the novel and before we talk to Sally about it, we did think it was probably worth having Stevie with us here in some capacity because she was so extraordinary and so wonderful. So we have a few...
And a brilliant performer, really amazing performer.
We have a few recordings of her reading her poetry, which we're going to play at various points. And so we're going to start with her most famous poem, Not Waving, But Drowning.
Nobody heard him, the dead man, but still he lay moaning. I was much further out than you thought, and not waving, but drowning. Poor chap, he always loved larking, and now he's dead. It must have been too cold for him, his heart gave way, they said. Oh, no, 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 it was too cold always. Still the dead one lay moaning. I was much too far out all my life, and not waving, but drowning.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
What is that accent? Is it sort of London?
I think it's London helium.
Yeah.
She's definitely on helium or something, isn't she?
It's incredible. Yeah.
She's on gin and helium.
Gin and helium, the perfect
combination. So we're going to talk about The Holiday, which is Stevie Smith's third novel. Sally, can you tell us a bit about... I will do what we do on Backlisted.
We're going to do,
which is,
we do the, you know, the blurb. Should we do
let's
the blurb?
Let's do the blurb first. Yeah, we normally read the blurb of the books on Backlisted. We all just agreed before we started doing this that The Holiday is one of the most challenging books that we've done on the podcast. And therefore, it's probably good to tell you the plot, or at least the basis of what there is of the plot.
There is no plot.
Now, so I'm just going to read I have an early 90s Virago edition here.
We've got lots of Virago editions here, haven't we?
It has a quote from Stevie Smith describing the book to start with, where she said, I won't do the voice because she does it much better. Beautiful. Richly melancholy, like those hot summer days when it is so full of that calm before the autumn, it quite ravishes me. When I read it, the tears stream down my face. That's her blurbing her own book. That's pretty good. Best known for her poetry, Stevie Smith wrote only three novels, of which Novel on Yellow Paper is perhaps the most famous. But The Holiday, as she testifies above, was her favourite. Celia works at the ministry in the post-war England of 1949 and lives in a London suburb with her beloved aunt. Witty, fragile, quixotic, Celia is preoccupied with love for her friends, her colleagues, her relations, and especially for her adored cousin Casmilius, with whom she goes on holiday to visit Uncle Heber, the vicar. Here they talk endlessly, argue, eat, tell stories, love and hate, moments of wild humour alternating with waves of melancholy as Celia ponders obsessively on the inevitable pain of love. In everything she wrote, Stevie Smith's poetic, special eye captured the paradox of pain in all human affections, nowhere more so than in this wry, strongly autobiographical tale. I think that's a good blurb.
It's a very good blurb. I mean, it is just, again, I had not read any Stevie Smith. I'd read some poems that had been anthologised. So I had we try and do with the podcast is I always try and be the guinea pig and go into a book with as few preconceptions. I tend not to read the introductions, tend not to read any of the stuff around it, and just try and encounter the text. And it is as disorienting, I think, as maybe first picking up Light in August by William Faulkner. I mean, this is not a book that immediately gives itself away. It's very, very, it's very intense. Mm. It takes you a while to get used to the fact that she doesn't use any, she punctuates in a very loose way. I mean, you just have to, the flow of the voice is there, the reported dialogue, you have to concentrate quite hard to, but when you sort of settle into the rhythm of the book, it is really remarkable. I mean, and so, again, for a book that was written in, I mean, it had a difficult publishing history, didn't it? It was written
during the Second World War, but it's not published until nearly 5 years
until 1949,
years afterwards. Sally, where did you first encounter this book?
So I first encountered this as a late teenager, in fact, sixth form college, where I had a teacher who was having a big rash on Stevie Smith. And so the poetry first and then the novels. So as a teenager, and I think as a first reader of Smith, and he's quite right, this is a difficult novel because it doesn't have a plot. But what it does invite you into is a series of swimming conversations. You swim around these conversations as though you were in a kind of eddy or whirlpool. You're not quite sure where you're going next. Mm. It invites you into quite a closed world of cousins, her cousins, right? Mm-hmm. And of classical friendship. And you're trying to work out where the lines of affection are between one person and another. Yeah. So you're radically and wildly and unsettlingly anxious about who you are with.
Yes.
And who they are in relation to you.
Yeah, who's going out with who.
Who fancies who or who likes who. And I think it captures wonderfully
Getting off with, yeah.
That sort of playground fear of who's my friend and who hates me. And who likes me and who loves me. And I think she's brilliant on that instinctive fear of affection and then lack of affection.
I think Celia in the book is an unreliable narrator, but not in the terms that we would normally understand that phrase. Mm-hmm. I think she's telling the truth. I think she's compelled to tell the truth. But she's unreliable because of how her mood swings.
Yes.
And she's totally true to whatever mood might be passing through her at the moment, in the moment of telling you about it
as well.
Absolutely. It's really kind of fearless and reckless.
Yeah. Yeah, it's,
you know, it's I know that another author we talked about on Backlisted quite often, but Novel on Yellow Paper was a great favourite of Gene Rees's. And indeed, it has that same kind of willingness to throw yourself onto the tracks emotionally and artistically and seeing what happens.
It's that extraordinary ability to go within a single paragraph, and we'll read some bits out, but from what seems like artless, almost faux naivety, to really profound insights into psychology and history. I mean, the book is full of references to, there's an early period that some of the cousins have shared in India together. So the question of the future of India is endlessly debated. The ennui of the post-war years, they're all working as cryptographers and secretaries in government ministries. It has a connection in some ways emotionally to that sort of sense of that you had in the Balchin novel, Darkness Falls from Air. There's a definite sense of it being very located in a specific moment. But as we'll go on to discuss, I think it also becomes remarkably prescient and relevant to where we find ourselves today.
Sally, have you got a bit that you could...
Absolutely.
Be bold enough to read?
I am definitely bold enough to read.
Great.
As I confessed earlier in my talk, I was the school narrator.
never Joseph or Mary.
Nor an angel, nor a donkey, nor a palm tree. So, and just to pick up on the contemporaneousness of this novel, it is difficult because in some sense it's not a novel at all. It's a series of swirling ideas. It's a series of conversations. It's very classical. It's a symposium. But there is this fixation with the mood of England and with an English kind of melancholy and sadness. England that gives up on itself. Ringing any bells?
Yeah.
England that gives up on itself. The idea of Englishness is then attached to family history and, as I've already said, to lines of affection. England's relationship to Germany, she is being written during the Second World War, but actually isn't published until 49, so there's a strange relationship between pre-war, middle of war, and post-war. We're never quite sure where we are. So history is very slippery and unknown. English relations to Germany is one of the key international relationships of the book. And I want to read a little bit from the beginning where Celia is in conversation with her cousin Kaz via the English and the English and Germans. Kaz went on to say that the Germans, in their careful way, had always made a great study of the English and might almost be said to graduate in it. But sure enough, though they might say the English race was biological and how that the English sat in front of their damned smoky fires just staring into them and not doing a thing about the draft under the door, just lounging and suffering, like you, Celia, were bound to trip up, as with the fake prisoner of war letters they shot down over England with the bombs, so that number 4, Acacia Grove, a Bermondsey, might be laid flat. But floating down upon the owner, maybe fathom deep in rubble, would be this fake letter from Harry Boy to say how fine the Germans were being to him in his Stalag and what decent chaps they were and how much they loved the English, etc. Only, of course, they couldn't know. They got it wrong. The poor Germans couldn't know, for they all read his letters. That boy Harry never said darling to his mum, and had never so much as mentioned the Germans one way or the other, not during the whole long years he was in camp, and how he always said in every letter, least said, soonest mended. So all the way from dear mum and dad to all the best, Harry, there was nothing in Harry's letters, the most college-raised chap in Deutschland, not by industry nor cunning, could lay his hand to for a true twist propaganda pill.
Amazing.
You've got the gig. That was brilliant, actually. What's so interesting is the difference between Stevie Smith's poetry, which is remarkably tight in terms of its use of words
and direct,
and the fiction in terms of how it uses speech in particular. I found this lovely thing that Rachel Cook, our former guest on the podcast, Rachel Cook, said about the voice that Stevie Smith uses in this book and in all her novels. She says it has irony, wit, a slight edge of malice, and the feeling that everyday speech, in all its repetitive clumsiness, has been brought magically close to poetry.
Yeah.
But also that Stevie manages to put poetry into very odd places and very strange speech.
I think it was one of the people at Chapman & Hall, or editor at Chapman & Hall, complained that the book was mostly poetry. I mean, there is a lot of poetry in it, but I think it's more...
Poetry clippings.
Yeah, it's also full of quite a lot of Latin, quite a bit of German and French. I mean, there is a sort of stream of consciousness sort of feel to the whole thing. But, I mean, I think the relationship with Germany is interesting. There's also a thinly veiled portrait of Orwell in there, the character of Basil, who she was close to Orwell, Stevie Smith. There was rumours that they had an affair, but I don't think they were ever a bit like the rumours of her lesbian affair. None of these things are very clear. I mean, it is a very, very biographical novel. But I like the bit also that the beginning, the coming sense of America and consumerism that is beginning to sort of affect. There's this, I think, wonderful passage from Basil, who said that America would be the ruin of the moral order. He said that the more gadgets women had and the more they thought about their faces and their figures, the less they wanted to have children. He said that he happened to see an article in an American woman's magazine about scanty panties. He said women who thought about scanty panties never had a comfortable fire burning in the fireplace, or a baby in the house, or a dog, or a cat, or a parrot, or a canary, I said. Or a canary, went on Basil. It's a very good, you get a very good sense from that of going from this, you know, kind of oratorial high kind oratory. Of high oratory, and then suddenly she brings it down with a joke.
I just want to read. I just want to say something. Sally, you were saying how you found this book as a teenager.
Yes. It's moody, right? Like a teenager. It's a very moody book.
Yes. I read Novel on Yellow Paper for the first time a year ago, and I just want to read the opening paragraph of Novel on Yellow Paper, because I think the opening paragraph of Novel on Yellow Paper,
and this is a book where she wanted to get her poems published, and the publisher, as they still do, said, go and write a novel.
So she did, in 6 weeks. I'm going to read you the beginning, but before I read you the beginning, I just want to tell you the context in which I read it. I just completed a month-long reading of Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace.
Woohoo!
And I had found reading Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace to be often enjoyable, often frustrating, very male, very maximalist, no thought unexpressed for 1,129 pages or something. But I completed it, I finished reading it, and then I was visiting a friend of mine called Neil, who is here today. Hello, Neil. And we went to a bookshop, and spontaneously, I saw a lovely little Penguin Modern Classics copy of Novel on Yellow Paper. I opened it up and I read these words, and I thought, I felt like a great David Foster Wallace-shaped weight lifted from my shoulders, right? Here we go. This is the beginning of Novel on Yellow Paper. Beginning this book, not as they say book in our trade, they mean magazine. Beginning this book, I should like to say, if I may, that is the way Sir Phoebus writes, I should like then to say goodbye to all my friends, my beautiful and lovely friends. And for why? Read on, reader. Read on and work it out for yourself. I think that is the best opening to a novel that I've read for many, many years. And what I think is so, now I know a bit more about Stevie, so you can probably tell us about this, is that isn't a pose that she's taking there.
It's a method.
She actually shed many friends as a result of publishing this book. She was estranged from many people in her life, some of them permanently, right? Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. And may I just to pick up on what... Thank you very much, Andy, for reading that. In terms of friends and then fans, in 1962, Stevie Smith receives a letter from the august poet Sylvia Plath, who is in her heyday, her young heyday. She's 30, 31. And she writes to Stevie Smith as a fan. And before I read the letter to you, which is devastatingly crushing from Smith's side anyway, to young Sylvia, I want to mention a couple of young people who I've been honoured to know, who have actually taught me about Stevie Smith. And they are my students. One of them is now not a student. He's now a world expert on Stevie Smith. His name is Will May, and he was the recent editor for the New Faber edition. An extraordinary achievement.
That is a wonderful
book. Amazing book.
Extraordinary new edition of Stevie Smith's poetry and prose and...
Drawings.
Much of which comes from the Tulsa University Library, which none of us really have easy access to. So thank you, Will. Thank you, Will May. He also wrote an extraordinary book about Stevie, which brought her back into the limelight a few years ago. And then the second student I want to mention, who is also a world expert on Stevie Smith, is Noreen Massoud. And if any of you want to have easy access to Smith, she has this most extraordinary blog called Parrots Ate Them All. Parrots Ate Them All. And it's from that blog that I'm reading to you now, the letter that Plath wrote to Smith, and then Smith's reply. It's Smith's reply I want to read to you now. Dear Sylvia Plath, thank you so much for your letter. I was glad to hear from you and glad you enjoyed the Harvard record. I'm afraid I really don't know where you would find a copy of Novel on YP now. It did go into a Penguins in 1950, I think it was, but that sold out and they did not reprint. When I go downstairs, I camp upstairs most of the time with my aged aunt. She is 90. But when I go upstairs, or is it downstairs, I will look out the address of a man who sometimes manages to track down books for me. He lives in this neighbourhood, oddly enough, but is very shy. Just sends the book and the AC, which, after all, is all that one wants. I do hope your novel goes well, and I do hope the move in the new year goes well too. If only as you suggest, so that we can meet sometime. I feel awfully lazy most of the time. Even the idea of writing a novel makes me feel rather faint. And as for poetry, I'm a real humbug. Just write it. Sometimes, but practically never, read a word. That makes me feel pretty mean-spirited when poets like you write such nice letters. Yours ever, Stevie Smith.
Ooh, it's amazing.
I have to say this. So Sylvia Plath was a big, great admirer of Stevie Smith. So, of course, was Morrissey.
Of course.
And indeed, it's speculated that the name The Smiths partly comes from his love of Stevie Smith.
And her name Stevie came from a jockey.
Yeah.
She was named after a jockey.
But he says in his autobiography.
Penguin Classics.
Yeah. My senses sharpen at the words of Stevie Smith. She appeared to live like a never-opened window. That's not bad, is it?
That's pretty good.
It's not bad. When Novel on Yellow Paper was published, it was a sensation, was it not? Mm-hmm. It was a bestseller, published in 1936. It made her a celebrity overnight. Somebody wrote to Virginia Woolf saying, "You are Stevie Smith and I claim my £5. Or words to that effect, that it was believed that Stevie Smith was a pseudonym and that it was a lighter version of what Virginia Woolf was trying to do in terms of the revolutionary use of speech and stream of consciousness. And yet, at the same time, the more you read about Stevie Smith, you realise she has this very strange aesthetic that is made up of depression, suburbia, death as a deliverance from the pain
death
of being
death
alive.
Death is always an option for escape from.
Yeah. And death is kind of a leisure option almost. Yeah. You know, it's like we're on holiday. We could do some death. You know, maybe let's.
And that's and there's an extraordinary part of the holiday where she describes. I'm not even sure about this. So I'm looking at you quizzically as I say it. Where she describes a suicide attempt.
Mm. Yeah. Yes.
It is a suicide attempt,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
But
yes.
it's delivered. Very. You know, she'll give you two paragraphs about parrots.
Very deadpan, or apes.
Or apes, and then say in passing, and I feel tired, and I decide to lie down in the water, and is saved from drowning. She's saved from drowning, isn't
yes,
she?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's a remarkable because she's just carried away by the stream and is rescued. But there's no struggle. I mean, she's just lying, being drifting downstream.
And I suppose what she's doing it. I mean, she's drawing us into a dream state. Smith is a great fan of the reverie, right? The idea that you can look at a fire, you watch the crackling fire, and you transport yourself somewhere else. So, in a sense, this book comes out of a dream state. It comes out of transportation, being moved somewhere else, having gone somewhere else, hence the holiday. The holiday, in a sense, is a metaphor for that dream state. It's very Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
But it's Alice in Wonderland is very dark, but you know, the menace here is of real things. It's death in a fairy tale sense, and the book ends in a fairy tale trance, doesn't it? But it's also death caused by war, death caused by empire, death caused by politics, bad politics. And it's a very political book as well. And John and I were discussing this before we came in, the way in which it takes on England's relationship to Europe and then to the globe, which is strikingly relevant to our current state of affairs.
Absolutely.
So I really want to challenge us to think about ways in which this book could be read as a comment on England now. You know.
Yeah.
There's a passage which strikes me as about England, which is, I think it's Kaz, who tends to be even more, the cousin in the book, who tends to be even more cynical than her. He says, "We are not a sophistical people and are saved the dangers that run with sophism. And our education has not yet succeeded in taking away from us the weapons of our strength, insularity, pride, xenophobia, and good humour." That could pretty much be a UKIP slogan.
Shall I just say a bit of biographical stuff about Stevie? Because I feel we need to do that. So she's born in 1902 and she dies in 1971. Florence Margaret Smith, called Peggy by her family, and as John said, picks up and the nickname of Stevie because some boys shout out that she's like a jockey called Steve. Is that right?
Yes,
I think
right.
So, yeah. And so her father was a shipping agent. He leaves home when she's three.
He goes off to sea.
Off to Valparaiso, Daddy.
And she moves to a suburban house in Avondale Road, Palmer's Green, where she lives for most of the rest of her life with her aunt Madge, played in the film Stevie by the incredible Mona Washbourne.
Oh, yes.
It was nothing like Aunt Madge in real life. I was reading, much to my amusement. Aunt Madge was formidable.
And Stevie's played by Glenda Jackson.
And the play was revived last year with Zoe Wanamaker.
Absolutely.
And so she called her aunt the Lion Aunt. And when she was five, she develops TB and she's sent to a sanatorium near Broadstairs for 3 years. Her mother was often ill. Her mother dies when she's 16. Mm-hmm. And it's these elements, death, women, suburbia, that provide inspiration for many of her poems. Death as a deliverer from depression or illness. She works at Nunes Publishing for 30 years as a secretary to Sir Neville Pearson, and she published 7 volumes of poetry in her lifetime, the most famous of which was Not Waving But Drowning in 1957. 3 novels, Novel on Yellow Paper, Over the Frontier, 1938, and this one, The Holiday. And we were talking last night, Sally, she fell out of fashion.
Yes.
She was very successful in the 1930s. She fell out of fashion in the 1940s and 50s and came to dislike these novels because she felt they had fixed her as a 1930s fad rather than as an author. But then in the 1960s, and I think we have another poem that we could play of a live recording from 1965. In the 1960s, Stevie Smith becomes a celebrity all over again as a live performer. Mm. She manages to get onto the 60s poetry gig circuit.
She's on the circuit
and become one of its mascots almost. Mm-hmm. Almost in a sort of, I was thinking, she reminds me of Ivor Cutler in a way. She has that brilliant English eccentric, although he was Scottish, of course, thing going on. Do we have one of those poems now?
Here is a happy love poem I wrote. It is called I Remember. It was my bridal night, I remember. An old man of 73, I lay with my young bride in my arms, a girl with TB. It was wartime, and overhead, the Germans were making a particularly heavy raid on Hampstead. What rendered the confusion worse, perversely, our bombers had chosen that moment to set out for Germany. Harry, do they ever collide? I do not think it has ever happened, oh my bride, my bride.
What a pro. Wait for the laugh, wait for the laugh, wait for the applause. Brilliant.
I think just to pick up on what you were saying about her circuit, her fame on the circuit. She's so attached, I think, to the Victorian music hall tradition as well. She's interested in snatches of words that float through the air that are sing-song, right? Nursery rhymes and sing-song, language that's breaking out into something else altogether, a hum or a tune.
Yes.
And I think that's why it's so difficult to read. And as I was reading that passage, my diaphragm was contracting and expanding nervously because I felt as though I ought to be breaking out into a song and doing a bit of tra-la-la-ing around the edge. And in fact, she has got these starlags and the way that she's sort of playing with the ridges between German and French and Italian, this kind of schoolgirlish relationship to knowing languages. I don't know if anyone else have. I have days where I suddenly speak really bad French because I was sent away when I was young to Switzerland, and there's something about that early relationship with language.
Yeah.
And it's a schoolgirl understanding of European languages, and she runs that through nursery rhyme and then the music hall tradition of song, which of course is rude and crude and colloquial, and is to do with rumour and gossip and hearsay.
Have you got another little bit you could read us there
yes,
from the holiday?
And then absolutely.
I have a question to ask.
Yes, I have.
And to my other panel members, so Sally, go.
And I'm afraid I'm staying with the idea of the English, if that's all right. If we can take a bit more of the English without getting too turned off. So they're talking. Most of the book is a series of conversations. She's still with her cousin Kaz, who she's in love with. They're now, the whiskey's now out. So we're in the whiskey scene. That's the spirit, said Kaz. Pass the whiskey. The English law is above the world, I said. It is not to be bought. It is strong, flexible, and impartial. Kaz began to sing. The law is the embodiment of everything that's excellent. It has no kind of spot or flaw, and I, my lords, embody the law. And this new whipping law, this emergency whipping act, they have passed for India. It is this inflammable student material, I said, wringing my hands. For indeed, I felt it to be a shameful thing. It was a horrible necessity, I said, pleading with Kaz. Surely, for instance, it is better than shoot the boys. Oh yes, much better, said Kaz, because you can do it several times. It is always such fun. I remember how I used to enjoy it so much at school. We always had this clean, wholesome fun. We derive great pleasure from it, eh, Tiny? Tiny, look away. I think there's a great deal of nonsense talked about this flogging business at public schools, he said. After all, what is it? Nothing. You did not used to think so, said Kaz. That's the spirit, I said. Pass the whiskey. The British will always eventually pass flogging laws because the governing classes are flogged themselves so much through the public schools. I was flogged twice through Homer, said Kaz, with another malicious look in my direction. I agree with Tiny, I said in a desperate manner. Too much is made of it. Some men writers make so much of it, as some women writers will always be making of the stress and strain of childbirth. Well, that cannot be so easily removed.
That's wonderful. So my question to Sally and to you, John, is I think these are utterly wonderful novels. I am so pleased to have read them in the last year or so. I think they are, I hope people listening to this, they're all in print at the moment. You can get them. You don't have to get them on eBay like some of the books we talk about sometimes on Backlisted. You could stop listening to us now.
Yeah.
Go and get one of these books, The Holiday or Novel on Yellow Paper. They're wonderful novels. Was she a wonderful novelist?
What a really interesting distinction to make.
I'd say she's an anti-novelist, actually. Yeah. I think she's an anti-novelist, like Herman Melville's Moby Dick, which is a whaling manual, actually, in its basic form. It's a whaling manual. And I don't know how we each of us felt reading this, but I was a schoolgirl again, looking up words and looking up things. So the part that I didn't just read, which carries on, we have the Battle of Thermopylae, which is one of the wars, the big Persian-Spartan war in the 5th century BC. But there I was. I know this, but I was looking it up just in case I get it wrong. Mm. And there's something about this book and knowledge and the way in which she brings us into snippets of snippets and fragments of knowledge, which are running around inside the pages of this novel, as obviously they were running around inside her head. And you can't really read a paragraph without having to look something up, because it's full of illusion, isn't it? And it's full of remnants of learning.
It's a really good question, and I think it is exactly that. There's a very snooty essay of T.S. Eliot, who did a good line in Snooty Essays, about William Blake, and he basically patronises Blake by saying, you know, he kind of makes rather interesting furniture out of the odd bits and pieces of. Mm-hmm. He basically accuses Blake of not having proper classical learning, which is, as it turns out, not true. But there is a sense in which Stevie Smith is an English writer in the way that Blake is an English writer. She stands outside any obvious tradition. She has made this incredibly deceptively. I think she had a persona, as you can hear from the voice of being somebody who was kind of amusing and a bit eccentric and a bit mad and high low. But the novels are so. I mean, there's so much in The Holiday. I mean, there's so much compacted in there, so much thinking and talking, and it kind of hangs together. But you can't say that she's like I say, you know, maybe someone as kind of. I mean, you can't really say she's like Virginia Woolf, I don't think.
No, she's definitely not like Virginia.
For me, I found that the little thing I was reading from the beginning of Novel on Yellow Paper, read on, reader, read on and work it out for yourself. Mm. That, for me, is what I loved about reading these books. Mm. I think they're incredibly, the sense of freedom within them, and that they are incredibly freeing to read, because they are drawing on certain traditions, but they are not the traditions or the aesthetic of a novelist, of a trading novelist. Mm. They are someone who is attempting to get down on paper what's in their head in a hierarchy of meaning for them, which allows you to wander around it.
Totally original. Can I read one really quick passage?
Yes,
this is Kaz again, and this is the relationship between Kaz and Celia. The way she, I mean, Kaz is kind of, this is very Seneca. You know, this is Greek philosophy. Life is like a railway station, said Kaz. The train of birth brings us in. The train of death will carry us away. And meanwhile, we're cooling our heels upon the platform and waiting for the connection and stamping up and down the platform and passing the time of day with the other people who are also waiting, which is quite good. But this is what she does. Yes, that is how it is. Of course, for everybody, it is not like this. For firmer types, It is different.
For firmer types.
That's how the play and the film of Stevie by Hugh Wymore, that's how it starts, with that exact train image. And as the train is now pulling out of the station, Matt informs me. So we have to wind up, I'm afraid.
Great. Well, I think that's all we have time for. Thanks to Sally, to our producer Matt Hall, to our sponsors Unbound, but thanks most of all to our audience here at the Gala Theatre Studio at the Durham Book Festival. Thank you.
Thanks very much, everyone. I think Stevie Smith would have been appalled by what's happened.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure she would.
My singing especially.
You can get in touch with us on at Backlisted Pod on Twitter, Facebook, Backlisted Pod, our page on Unbound site, which is unbound.co.uk/backlisted. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with another show in a fortnight. Good night from me.
Good night from me.
Good night from Stevie.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.